Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Connie Sulem, director of the American Kurdish Information Network, who discusses Donald Trump's reckless policies that triggered Turkey's military offensive against the Kurds in northern Syria, destabilizing the volatile region. Stephen Hassan, a mental health professional and author of the new book titled The Cult of Trump, who explains why he believes the president fits the psychological profile of a cult leader. And Norman Clement, an Indigenous People's Day organizer, who talks about the movement of cities and states deciding to drop the Columbus holiday in favor of a day honoring Native peoples. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
October 19th could be a critical day for Britain's Labour Party. That's the day pro-European Union members of the UK's Parliament may push for a second referendum on Brexit. It also comes the day after an EU summit meeting and the date Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson must finalize his plan for Britain to leave the EU. Johnson pledged to leave the EU by the end of October without a deal if he can't negotiate an alternative, despite Parliament's vote mandating an extension be sought for further negotiations. London's Labour mayor, Sadiq Khan, has called on his party to support a second referendum rather than fudging its position during the next election campaign against the Conservative Party. In recent days, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn has shaken up his inner circle in anticipation of the upcoming general election. Labour's leadership has been torn for many months between what it sees as the need to reach out to pro-Brexit voters in Labour constituencies and the party's membership, which strongly supports remaining in the EU. Despite the opportunity to launch a national debate on Labour's progressive policy platform in the next election, which includes net zero carbon emissions, abolition of private schools, and shutting down migrant detention camps, Corbyn's popularity is hampered by his muddled position on Brexit. If Corbyn loses to Johnson, the nation will face the unleashing of 5 years of nativist rule. The U.S. Supreme Court opened up its new term with a set of sex discrimination cases involving gay and transgender plaintiffs. The cases revolve around job discrimination against LGBTQ people involving Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The High Court's rulings will be an early test of the new conservative majority on the Supreme Court, which includes new Trump-appointed justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. It will also gauge the impact of retired Justice Anthony Kennedy's absence, who has held the center on earlier gay rights cases. The issue of discrimination against gays and transgender people could split conservatives, as court observers say it's difficult to support the position that LGBTQ people are not protected by Title VII. However, lawyers for the Trump administration argue using the term sex in its originalist conception, which they interpret as only referring to biological sex, not sexual orientation or gender identity. Through the term, the Supreme Court will hear a succession of divisive cases involving abortion, gun control, aid to religious schools, and the status of 800,000 Dreamers, young immigrants brought to the U.S. by their parents. On November 12th, the court will hear a pivotal DACA case challenging President Trump's move to kill protections for young immigrants granted by President Obama. For years, families of mixed-status immigrant households lived in public housing units, paying market rents, providing stability for families, and income for public housing authorities. Now, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is proposing a new rule that would evict an entire family from public housing if a single member of that household is undocumented. According to The Nation magazine, this Trump regime proposal has set off a wave of fear among immigrant families living in public housing or using Section 8 housing vouchers. A well-organized campaign has fueled opposition to the HUD proposal, and housing advocates are preparing to go to court to fight the rule and will seek an injunction in New York City or California courts to prevent the evictions from going forward. If the rule were to be implemented, it would result in the estimated nationwide eviction from federal subsidized housing and loss of Section 8 vouchers of over 100,000 people, including 55,000 children who are U.S. citizens or legal residents. In New York City alone, 11,000 tenants could be evicted from public housing. Most families affected by this new policy would be those who currently live in New York, California, and Texas. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
An inexplicable phone call between U.S. President Trump and Turkish President Erdogan on October 6th resulted in Trump issuing an order for a rapid pullout of American troops from northern Syria, giving Turkey a green light to invade the region that's been occupied by the Syrian Democratic Forces, militarily led by the Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG. Turkey's offensive against the Kurds includes forces formerly affiliated with both al-Qaeda and ISIS that have been seen on video conducting summary executions of civilians and politicians. Erdogan justifies his attack by claiming that Syrian Kurdish forces are allied with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, that is accused of carrying out terrorist attacks inside Turkey. The Turkish leader says his goal is to create a so-called safe zone inside Syria, to which he wants to resettle more than 3 million Syrian war refugees, now in Turkey. In the first week of the Turkish offensive, more than 800 ISIS prisoners have escaped, as their Kurdish guards were forced to leave their posts to defend themselves in the current battle. Your reporter spoke with Connie Zulam, director of the American Kurdish Information Network, who discusses the reckless policies of Donald Trump that triggered Turkey's attack and caused the Kurds to recently ally themselves with the government of Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad, who is militarily supported by Russia and Iran.
The militia group that Turkey is supporting, they're unfortunately former al-Qaeda or ISIS fighters. They glory in killing, in summary executions, and they don't even mind videotaping themselves and putting on the social media. The mastermind behind it is, unfortunately, Erdogan, the ruler of Turkey, the president of Turkey. This plan may be his, but the underwriter is President Trump, unfortunately. Without his green light, this war would not have been unleashed. Many people in the military say so. Turkey has no power to challenge the U.S. One simple no from Trump would have stopped it. I'm not a psychologist. I don't know what's going on in his head, other than to say that he seems to get along really well with dictators, and he has no empathy. On top of, you know, this bloodbath, this close to 140,000 Kurds have fled their homes. He blames them for example, he tweeted that they had run away from a battle in Syria, which wasn't the case. He was referring to Kirkuk in Iraq. Instead of saying that it's unfortunate or somehow some sympathy, some empathy, none of that. On top of it, is he's making fun of the Kurds. It's a dark, dark moment in our history. It easily could have been avoided. And Erdogan himself wants to kick out the 2 million Kurds that are living in this area of Syria and settle 3.6 million refugees, Sunni, Muslim, Arabs in this area who have sought refuge in Turkey. These are Sunni Arabs who are from Western Syria. They're not even from this area of Syria. But he seems to be okay with doing social engineering or ethnic cleansing and playing with people the way a cat plays with a mouse or the way a chess player plays with a pawn on a chessboard.
Connie, Turkish President Erdogan claims that the forces in northern Syria, the YPG, are aligned with a Turkish Kurdish group called the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, that has been accused of terrorism through many decades in Turkey. What's the response to the idea that somehow the YPG in northern Syria, the Kurds there, presents some kind of threat to the nation of Turkey?
You know, Turkey is 80 million, has an army that's half a million. The YPG area had 5 million population and had an armed militia that numbers 70,000. Since it was established, they have never attacked Turkey. To say that Kurds pose a threat to Turkey is like to say Mexico poses a threat to U.S. I mean, it's laughable. It's completely baseless. It has absolutely nothing to do with facts. The Kurds wanted to get along with Turkey. They wanted to trade with Turkey the way their cousins in Iraqi Kurdistan are trading with Turkey. But Erdogan and the ruling circles in Turkey simply can't fathom the idea of Kurds with political rights. Yes, the point you made earlier, the YPG has a relationship with the PKK, but even PKK is trying to have peace with Erdogan.
Connie, I did want to ask you one more recent development. Kurds have made an 11th-hour alliance with the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad, a former adversary. Assad, of course, is supported by Russia and Iran. This cooperation agreement was made, the Kurds in northern Syria say, to protect themselves from the Turkish invasion, and they realized it was a compromise that they needed to make to save their people. Can you comment?
Correct, exactly. This is what their general, Muslim Kobani Abdi, said in a very well-written, lengthy opinion piece in Foreign Policy. Your listeners can Google it. He says, you know, we wanted to basically remain autonomous. They were hoping U.S. would back their political aspirations in Geneva when finally parties to the war got together and wanted to put an end to the war in Syria. But when Turkey began to attack and when Turkey expressed, telegraphed or loudly suggested that they would ethnically cleanse this area, General Abdi said, this is genocide. We're not going to let that happen. We have to save our people. And he reached out to Bashar al-Assad. And so Syrian army is now moving in to this one-third of Syria that was under the control of Syrian Democratic Forces. But Turkey hasn't stopped the war. As far as who can stop this war, there are two parties that can stop this war, Russia and U.S. U.S. has already said goodbye. And Russia is an ally of Bashar al-Assad, and it remains to be seen if Putin will be a humanitarian or let some more Kurds be wiped out or punished so that they could say uncle to Bashar al-Assad, his bigger ally in Syria.
That was Connie Sulam, director of the American Kurdish Information Network. Find more analysis and commentary about the current Turkish military offensive in northern Syria by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Donald Trump confronts the ongoing House impeachment inquiry and the possible end of his presidency over the snowballing Ukraine extortion scandal, the president retains firm support from about 40% of Americans, according to recent polls. While Mr. Trump has been the target of multiple investigations for allegations of collusion with Russia during the 2016 election, paying off a porn actress to keep her quiet about a sexual affair, obstruction of justice, and misuse of a public charity, his base supporters stay with him. And despite the fact that the president has been documented to have made more than 12,000 false and misleading statements since taking office in January 2017, a strong majority of Republican Party voters and politicians remain loyal to Trump. America's 45th president defies Democratic norms by regularly disparaging and blaming people of color and immigrants for both his own and the nation's problems, and calls journalists enemies of the people. Stephen Hassan, a cult survivor turned mental health professional and now director of the Freedom of Mind Resource Center, says that like cult leaders Jim Jones, L. Ron Hubbard, David Koresh, and Sun Myung Moon, Trump exhibits features of what psychologist Eric Fromm called malignant narcissism, bombastic grandiosity, a bottomless need for praise, lack of empathy, pathological lying, apparent sadism, and paranoia. In short, Hassan says, he fits the stereotypical psychological profile of a cult leader. Your reporter spoke with Stephen Hassan, author of the just-published book titled The Cult of Trump, a leading cult expert, explains how the president uses mind control. Here he explains why he believes Trump is a leader of a dangerous cult as opposed to an unorthodox politician with a passionate following.
I would start with the stereotypical profile of cult leaders that I have researched and studied. And he seems to have all the major pathological, narcissistic, malignant narcissistic qualities of major cult leaders. In fact, I have a chapter paralleling him with my former cult leader, the leader of Scientology, Hubbard, Lyndon LaRouche, Jim Jones, and a number of other cult leaders. And so what is that profile? Essentially, they're people who are incapable of empathy. They are so grandiose and extreme, thinking everything's about them. Everything's about their power and money and sex. They can't take criticism. They project all of their behavior on everybody else. They're often very sadistic, paranoid, teaching things in terms of black and white, us versus them, and thinking. And essentially, they want obedience. Sort of, to quote Donald Trump, he wants loyalty above all else. And like most cult leaders, he likes revenge, or to threaten revenge for anyone who crosses him. So there's no toleration for dissension, for people calling him out on his unethical behavior, which includes pathological lying, like no other cult leader I've actually encountered, so many lies in such a short period of time. And when it comes to him occupying the office of the presidency, you know, that office has a sacred, mystical power unto itself, as well as actual political power. And so if he wasn't in the office of the presidency, I don't think he would be able to wreak so much havoc and cause so much polarization and pain around the world, advancing elitism and authoritarianism, but using populist appeals and lying to the average person to make them believe that he actually is like them and cares about them. I go into issues of brainwashing, what the criteria are. I talk about my BITE model of mind control, how cult leaders control behavior, information, thoughts, and emotions to make people dependent and obedient. So there's a long laundry list I cover in my book about how destructive cult leaders operate. But what I didn't know, Scott, when I started researching the book, was just how many actual cult groups form the base of Donald Trump. And I believe that the media has been mischaracterizing the base as evangelical Christians, when in fact his base are people involved with cultic Christian-esque groups, ones that are often secret, but they all share the same desire to impose dominionism, what's called dominionism. They want to influence the government. They want to tear down the separation of church and state.
I'm wondering, from your perspective, having examined Donald Trump and his supporters, what can you tell us about the threat of violence here as we enter what many people believe is a constitutional crisis, where Trump and his administration are not cooperating with the House of Representatives in their impeachment inquiry, resisting subpoenas? I'm wondering if you're concerned that people, as they have in the past, invoke Trump's name to justify their violence. We've had supporters send pipe bombs to Trump opponents in the media and politics. We've had mass shootings where Trump's name is invoked for his condemnation of refugees and immigrants. What is the concern level we should all have here?
I'm very concerned, frankly. Unfortunately, history shows that cult leaders are not just con artists, but they actually believe their own grandiosity and extremism, and that they would rather take everybody with them rather than surrender power. So I've been concerned since Trump was elected and inaugurated that he was not going to be voted out of office, And I, you know, did a lot of studying of conspiracy promulgators like Alex Jones and others that have been pushing this narrative that America is headed for a civil war and that therefore they need to stockpile automatic rifles because there'll be mass riots everywhere and food will have shortages, etc. And so some folks have been primed for decades to expect this. So am I worried? Yes, I'm very worried. I'm more worried, honestly, about a nuclear first strike, which apparently has been discussed. And of course, I have a book called The Cult of Trump. So there are unstable people who are true believers and who might try to initiate something. And all I can say is I'm not going to be silenced and that I need to tell the facts as I know it. This is my expertise.
That was Stephen Hassan, author of The Cult of Trump. A leading cult expert explains how the president uses mind control. Learn more about competing views on Trump's role as a cult leader by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The history of Columbus Day has been officially intertwined with Italian culture in the U.S. since President Benjamin Harrison declared a one-time national holiday in 1892 on the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus sailing to the Americas. This occurred after 11 Italian Americans were murdered in New Orleans at a time when Italians were widely denigrated as dirty, lazy, and dangerous. In 1937, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in Congress declared it a national holiday to be celebrated annually after lobbying by the New Haven, Connecticut-based Catholic Fraternal Order, the Knights of Columbus. But in recent years, support has been growing to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day in recognition of the victims and survivors of the atrocities perpetuated by Columbus. To date, 8 states and many cities and counties have made the switch. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Norman Clement, an indigenous Penobscot man with roots in Maine, but who's a longtime New Haven, Connecticut resident and a Confederated member of the now almost disappeared local Quinnipiac people. He led a commemoration of Indigenous Peoples Day on October 14th on the New Haven Green and talked about his and other groups' efforts to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day and to make the new holiday truly meaningful.
States and cities have proclaimed, you know, Indigenous Peoples Day and done away with Columbus Day, right? But where, how are they teaching the history? Are they, we're not teaching the history of the Indigenous people that were here before. I think we need to do that in our schools. The curriculum needs to change. Board of Ed just said, we're going to start teaching Black history to our elementary schools and Latino history. But what about us? What about the history of the Quinnipiacs? What happened to them? There's so much history that we need to know about this country. And we need to know that before we can move on. We just can't gloss over the fact that 100 million people were killed. It's the biggest genocide ever, and we just gloss over it.
I did an interview with a woman in Massachusetts who was working to get a statewide declaration of Indigenous Peoples Day and to get rid of Columbus Day altogether, and she said sharing this date between Columbus Day and Indigenous Peoples Day is like sharing Adolf Hitler's birthday with Holocaust Memorial Day. Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean...
I told City Hall that. I told the alders that, you know. They didn't listen to me, obviously, you know? And here we are stuck with this again. This year, Columbus Day was celebrated on Saturday, I guess. I wasn't here, I wasn't in town, but I went by the statue over there this morning and saw all the wreaths on there that the politicians put on there. So you can't at one hand say you're okay with celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day while you're still doing that. And then Where are the politicians today that now that we have Indigenous Peoples Day? Why don't we have a Quinnipiac flag up on that flagpole? Where is it? Why are we left out? I want Columbus erased from history. Future generations should not even know who he was. This should never be mentioned again.
Are you optimistic that since other cities and even whole states are getting rid of Columbus Day and just making it Indigenous Peoples Day, that at some point either New Haven and or the state of Connecticut will do that?
Yeah, of course, of course. Columbus Day was proclaimed in, I think, 1924, somewhere around there. And we've had to live with it ever since. You know, it's changed a few times from being on the 12th to being on the Monday so that people can have a three-day weekend, you know. But it's been here since then. There's a lot of movement, and it's a positive sign that people are finally recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day. You know, next month is Indigenous Peoples Month. We're going to celebrate all month. I'm going to go to the National Day of Mourning, you know, as I go every year. This year is the 50th anniversary of the National Day of Mourning, so I hope that everybody makes it up there and hears the true story of Thanksgiving, or what is called Thanksgiving, because that was just another massacre that happened. You know, they celebrate.
Say more about that, because a lot of people don't even know what that is. What goes on, and what is that day?
Day of ceremony, a day of we do a blessing like we did here. There's speakers. Only Indigenous speakers can talk that day. There's actually two events that happened. One was the Wampanoag were invited into the village, and some of them were killed there on the spot that day. Then the English went down from Massachusetts, from Plymouth, or actually from Boston, to Mystic, Connecticut, and slaughtered over 700 Pequots in their sleep. When they went back, they had a celebration that became Thanksgiving.
That was Norman Clement, an Indigenous Penobscot man who led this year's local commemoration of Indigenous Peoples Day in New Haven, Connecticut. Find more perspectives on the Columbus Day holiday by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Radio Helsinki in Graz, Austria, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KYAQ in Toledo, Oregon, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.